I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Terry Gould joins me once again, the investigative journalist who's written about organized crime and social issues. There's a new book out, Murder Without Borders, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It is a fascinating book about seven journalists who have lived and died to tell the story. They pursue stories in spite of threats to their lives, bringing to light corruption on the part of military leaders, gangsters, paramilitary leaders, and politicians. In the 4 years Mr. Gould spent researching and writing this book, he traveled to Colombia, the Philippines, Bangladesh, Russia, and Iraq, countries where journalists are likely to be murdered on the job. It's not because of war, but because they are telling truths. Terry Gould has won numerous awards for his reporting. He was on last for his incredible book, Paper Fan, The Hunt for Triad Gangster Stephen Wong. This book is published by Random House. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Terry Gould. Good morning, Mr. Gould.
Thank you, Joseph, for having me. I'm honored to be on the show.
You're very welcome. Now, let's start at the very beginning of the book. You open the book with a quote from Vaclav Havel. Mm-hmm. Quote, "I am not interested in why man commits evil. I want to know why he does good." It's such a profound quotation and one worth pondering. You do that throughout the book.
Well, yes. I had covered organized crime for 20 years, and I had that same interest as Havel. I'd written about why people committed evil. Now I wanted to know why they did good, and I wanted to write about it. And studying the lives of murdered journalists gave me that opportunity. And there's one reason for that. When most people think a journalist dying for the story, they picture war correspondents caught in a crossfire, usually Western war correspondents. But in fact, murder, not war, is the leading cause of job-related deaths for journalists. So since 1992, there have been now 734 or 35, I think, there's one killed every few days, journalists who have died on the job. Almost three-quarters of those deaths were the result of being targeted and murdered. Over 95% of the masterminds of these murders have escaped punishment. And about 85% of journalists killed on the job for all reasons are local reporters, not foreign correspondents. So they live in these towns, and they get murdered in these towns, overseas in these countries. And many of these journalists who've been murdered have been threatened beforehand, and a great many of them have predicted they would be murdered for staying on the story. So, but they stayed on the story, and they got murdered. So I was wondering, what is it about them that motivated them to stay on a story knowing that they would be murdered? Because three or four of their, five of their other colleagues in that town had already been murdered for a similar story, or even that story. They seemed very, very unique people. I first got interested in this story while I was working on that that book you mentioned previously, Paper Fan. I was in the Philippines, in and out between 2000 and 2003, looking at organized crime and corruption and the links between government and the criminal structure. And during that period of time, 14 Philippine journalists were murdered, and no one was charged. And most of the journalists who died while I was in the Philippines during that period had been publicly threatened by public figures. And some had been offered bribes, they turned down the bribes, and then they were murdered, and no one was charged. And press freedom groups were protesting and saying, if nobody is charged for these 14 murders, then that's a green light to murder another journalist the next time a politician or a businessman or a policeman is offended by the writing of this journalist. And in fact, in 2004, the rate accelerated. Eight more journalists were murdered. May 2005, on Press Freedom Day, the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York published a list of the five most murderous countries for journalists. And at the time they were, in the order of the most killed, the Philippines was first then, Iraq, Colombia, Bangladesh, and Russia. And when I was looking over this long, long, long list of murdered journalists, I discovered almost all of them knew they would be killed if they persisted in their journalism, that they persisted, and that they were killed. But there was almost nothing on the internet about their personal lives. It was not the purview of NGOs, press freedom NGOs, to tell the personal lives of journalists. So I chose representative cases in these five most murderous countries, and I set off to visit their hometowns and interview their families and their colleagues, and in some cases, if I could, their killers and the masterminds of their murders, and try to understand their personal motivations. I searched for the one moment in their lives when they realized they were willing to die for their stories and why they had reached that point.
Was there something in common that they all had, like their background perhaps?
Yes, there was. I eventually saw a pattern and discovered the pattern and looked for that pattern. It was this, and it's something... it's something most people can relate to. They had each undergone a transformational moment early in their careers. Something that had happened to them, that they had witnessed, or that they had done to others, that convinced them that the powerful needed to be prevented from oppressing the weak at all costs. Don't forget, these five most murderous countries for journalists are also five of the most corrupt countries in the world. And these places are rife with personal, with people having individual experiences with violence and corruption. They are virtually nations that are run according to the principle of organized crime. If you ask most people, you know, what's organized crime, they're going to say the Sopranos or the Mafia. But really, at its most fundamental level, organized crime is a licensing system. A gangster, he moves his way, he murders his way to the top, and to make sure he stays there, he awards the right to engage in illegal activities in this territory. And he wants tribute in return, and he provides protection from the law. Well, that single mechanism governs all the nations where journalists are being murdered in the greatest numbers. And it's really interesting because it follows a universal modus operandi. And it's this, it's that the rise to power is always accompanied by the return of favors. But there's a twist here in terms of governance. In nations that are run according to a principle, this principle I've talked about of organized crime, favors are returned in the currency of impunity. So the political and the religious rulers of these countries act like gang bosses. And they appoint their subordinates to bureaucracies and official positions with the understanding that while their salaries are going to be low, their incomes will be high. So corruption, which is like an ad hoc arrangement in a lot of countries, is actually a form of structure in these particular countries where it's they're most murderous. So lawlessness actually occurs within the law, and a system of organized crime is locked into the business of the nation. And as this system perpetuates, the people are robbed and the rulers get rich, but anyone who attempts to defy the rulers will find out very quickly how organized crime can be. So if you look across borders, you know, across time back into history, this national licensing system is uniform. So if you understand that system, at how governments use it to rule billions of people over millions of square miles, you'll understand how a lot of the world works. And it's especially crucial to understand why journalists are murdered with impunity when they attempt to expose it, and why they are motivated to risk murder in order to expose it.
Does this happen in Canada and the United States as well?
In the last 10 years, there have been two journalists murdered. In Vancouver, a fellow publisher by the name of Tara Singh Hare was murdered. And in Oakland, a fellow by the name of Chauncey Bailey was murdered. These were two journalists that pursued dangerous stories. And the people they were exposing were dangerous. And they were, a lot of these murders are unsolved, right? So they, in all likelihood, their murders were connected to the stories they were on. But there's a difference. There is a difference. In most of these countries, the journalists are murdered either by the government, by law enforcement, or in connivance with the government and law enforcement. And let me explain how this works. I was under police protection for 6 months in 1990.
Right.
Police were living in the house. Never once did I fear that the police would accept a bribe from the Chinese mafia and come upstairs at night and put a bullet in my head. Never occurred to me. In these countries, there is no police protection because most of these people are, get murdered in, by connivance with the police. And the government, like for instance, in a place like Russia, you got a political leader. In the case of a journalist I wrote about, Anna Politkovskaya, she angered the leadership of Russia. Now, the leader of Russia is not going to sit in a cabinet meeting and say, I want you to kill that woman. I want it done on such and such a day. Well, what happened was, he just says, I don't like that lady. So his assistant hears, and then he tells his assistant, and his assistant tells his assistant, until finally it gets to a policeman who knows a criminal who does the deed. That's the way it happens. So there's never any connection between the boss and the actual deed itself. Maybe a low-level criminal is sometimes caught and charged, but you never can follow the line up. I bring up Anna because while I was on the road going from country to country, there were a lot of unexpected events I ran into. And one of them was that journalists were being murdered all the time. And one of them, Anna Politkovskaya, I was going on my way to meet in order for her to explain for me what it took for a journalist to stay on a story in the face of death threats. Now, Anna Politkovskaya had been writing about atrocities committed by the Russian army in Chechnya for years. And when she was still alive, I was going to Russia to write about these two young editors of a newspaper in Tolyatti, Russia, in central Russia, who had, one had been murdered, Valery Ivanov was murdered, he was exposing the Russian mafia and the government, and his partner, Alexei Sidorov, knew he too would be murdered if he picked up Valery Ivanov's mantle, and he did, he picked it up, and he knew he would be murdered, and he was murdered. Now, Anna Politkovskaya had she'd been arrested, she'd been tortured, she'd undergone a mock execution, And as I found out while researching her life, there was a journalist at her newspaper in Moscow, Novaya Gazeta, that had been murdered before her, and she'd stood at the casket and she'd said to a colleague, I will be next. So she knew. And because she was making public pronouncement about being aware that she'd probably be murdered, I thought, I would like to interview Anna Politkovskaya about what it takes for people like Valery Ivanov and Alexei Sidorov to stay on a story in Russia where 13, 14, 15 people had been targeted and murdered with connivance with the government. So we set our appointment for October 10th, 2006, on a Tuesday, and I flew into Moscow on a Saturday, and When I got off the plane, I picked up the phone to touch base with people in Moscow. I didn't know I was there, and I was on my way to Santa Polkovskaya, and they told me, "Well, you're too late. She got shot while you were in the plane on the way to see her. Shot to death."
Yeah.
So she became a chapter in my book about, and I added her life story again, searching for the time at her life when she'd had this transformational experience that made her willing to accept death as a consequence of her reporting. And in her case, there's an interesting story there. As with all these cases, they're very complex people, and they all have interesting antecedents. In Anna Polkovskaya's case, she was born to an elite Soviet family. Her dad was a United Nations diplomat in New York. She was born in New York. And when she came back to Russia as a young girl, in Soviet society, she was treated like an elite diplomat's daughter. She went to the best schools, she had good clothes, beautiful woman, grew up to be a beautiful woman, and she married a man who turned out to be the Dan Rather of Russian television news. But in the first years of her career, through the early 90s, mid-90s, she wrote almost exclusively about the elite intelligentsia and famous artists. She did profiles, people profiles. And she wore high fashion, and she carried herself like a model. And while she was writing about that, the first Chechen War was taking place. And she almost never mentioned it, if ever. And one day she decided she wanted to write a story about big-eyed Chechen children going to school for their human interest story, going to school their first day in Moscow. And she phones a refugee center, and she says to the woman, Svetlana Ganushkina, I want to do this story. And Ganushkina said to her, "Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but in Moscow, Chechen children aren't allowed to go to school. However, if you come down to the refugee center, you'll meet some Chechens." So they made an appointment, and what had happened was Boris Yeltsin was trying to pressure the Chechens to end this first Chechen war, and he bombed Grozny. And hundreds of refugees streamed out of Grozny, and they had just arrived at the refugee center when Anna Polkovskaya waltzed in her fashionable dress. So she sees lining the walls of this refugee center parents that had just lost children that had just lost parents, old people begging for medical attention, siblings who had lost other siblings, wailing and bandaged people, a horror. She walked into what was a horror, and she looked at herself, and the head of the refugee center said to me, "It was like watching a dancer move from one repertoire to another." And she had an epiphany. She said, "What am I writing about when this is going on?" And from that moment on, in late August 1996, she changed, and she dedicated herself to writing about Chechens for the rest of her life. And when the second Chechen war started in September, October 1999, she was down there like a shot, and she went right into the action, and she went to Chechnya 48 times over the next few years, risked her life in order to write about the civilians, not to cover the battles, but to write about the suffering of civilians and the atrocities committed against them.
These people, Terry, in this book that you write about seem to have affected you. And dare I say that they inspired you?
Yes. I must say I was deeply, deeply moved by all of them. There's one particular journalist, Manik Chandra Saha, in Khulna, Bangladesh, and he is the closest person to a saint I've ever encountered. Most of these journalists were not saintly. They had complicated lives, and they were obstreperous and tempestuous people with very strong wills, and you could see getting into an argument really easily. But Manik Chandrasekhar was much different. He had had his epiphany when he was a young teen in a wilderness area of the Sundarbans. Now, let me just set the scene here where Manik Chandrasekhar is from. He's from southwest Bangladesh, very remote part that's cut off from the capital by rivers and surrounded by swamps. And on the south is a wilderness area, a mangrove wilderness area, which is the last refuge of the Bengal tiger and sundari trees, which is the most expensive hardwood in Asia. And as a young man, he was canoeing, motoring through, or I think he was canoeing through this this wilderness area. Now, that area, that whole area, that district of Khulna, Bangladesh, is one of the most corrupt and violent areas of the world. It's ruled by what they call the Seven Godfathers, who are Bengal Mafia, and they control the Chamber of Commerce and the Mayor's Office. In addition to that, in the bush are jihadists and Maoist insurgents. And the Bengal Mafia has made alliances with these two crazy factions. Everyone's ideologically opposed, but crime makes them brothers. So they were people in that area would daily witness atrocities. Now, so Manik Shah is a young man. He's moving through the Sundarbans, and he has an epiphany, and he realizes that there must be a law of goodness in the universe, because of the 14 million people in the district of where he lived, Khulna, only about 1,000 would be what you would call bad people. The other 14,999,000 were good people. And he said, natural selection must have evolved this law of goodness in man. And for proof, he said, there's so many more good people than there are bad people. And for himself, he understood that whenever he did good, he felt good. And the more he thought about himself, for himself, the unhappier he was. And he said there's probably a scientific law of goodness that governs humanity, and that governs the universe at large. And that gave him a scientific principle to live for the rest of his life. Now, don't forget, he was an atheist.
Right.
He didn't believe in a hereafter. He didn't believe he would get rewarded for acting good. His reward was just being a part of nature and acting good so that he would feel good, and that would be do good to others. So when he became a journalist, he directly confronted these very, very powerful forces that were aligned against the law of goodness, and he never stopped. Journalists were being murdered all around him, but he continued to expose this cabal of evildoers, and he fought to get that Sundarban set aside as a national park and UNESCO World Heritage Site, because the Bengal Mafia, in league with their criminal brothers in the jihadist movement and the Maoist rebels, were logging the Sundarbans of the Sundari tree and destroying the mangroves in order to set up shrimp farms. They were also stealing hundreds of thousands of hectares of rice farms from farmers, and if the farmers wouldn't agree to give over the land, they'd rape the farm wives. So he began exposing all this in the press and in some of his books. And just like Anna Politkovskaya had stood over the casket of one of her murdered colleagues and said, "I will be next," Manik Chandra, shortly before he died, published a book, and when the press freedom groups came down to help celebrate the publication of the book about the Sundarbans, he said, "Anytime I can be killed. It's not, you know, it can happen any moment." So he had become president of the press club, and after his term ended, he continued these hard-hitting stories about these three factions I'm telling you about, the Bengal Mafia and the jihadists and the Maoists. And he was coming out of the press club. He's beloved by his fellow press club colleagues. There are 100 of them. He's coming out of there, and Bangladesh, they have a unique way of assassinating somebody. It's about the size of a baseball, and it's a little can, and it's stuffed with gunpowder and fishing weights. And usually, they will throw this gun, this little, what they call is a cocktail. They will throw this cocktail from about 30 feet away, 40 feet away, and it hits the person, it explodes, kills the target. But they had a special idea for Manik Sahi. He's a special guy, and he had to be killed in a special way. So they put a detonator in there and just put gunpowder in it so they could get right close to him. No shrapnel. And they came within 3 steps of him and threw it right at his head, and his head exploded. He was totally decapitated. And he fell right in front, right near the press club, about half a block away. So all the journalists poured out of the press club, and they beheld their beloved saint-like Manik Saha, former president, completely decapitated, his brains in a pink pool between his shoulders. And it was a lesson. This man is thinking wrong. Who's next? And many journalists in my book have been killed in symbolic ways just like that. Guillermo Bravo Vega in Colombia was shot in the heart, in the mouth, and the head. You're feeling wrong, you're talking wrong, and you're thinking wrong. And he too had a very interesting story. As I said, I kept searching for this transformational moment. They knew they would be killed. What is it that changed their hearts where they were willing to accept that they would be killed in order to pursue this story?
You mentioned earlier that you'd undergone police protection in 1990 over the Stephen Wong situation. What does your family make of your line of work?
Well, they know I'm very careful. They know that to pursue this particular book, they knew one thing, and this I know. I was not willing to die for this book, because if I died while researching this book, there would be no book. So it's not like these journalists that had worked on stories for 10, 15 years, and the last one got them killed, or one of the last ones got them killed. This book would either happen or it wouldn't happen. If I got killed in the middle of it, it wouldn't happen. So there was no logic to me to pursuing this book to the death, because there would be no book. So before I went to these places, my family was watching me do this the whole time. I would spend months planning an expedition. I would set up fixers who knew their way around these insurgency-ridden areas, who knew the officials, who knew the police. I'd set up a translator, and I'd set up a press freedom guy who'd be my lifeline. And I'd come into the town, and I wouldn't be there more than 3 minutes before everybody in the town knew why I was there. Mastermind of the murder, some of whom I interviewed, some of these guys, knew I was not targeting them. I was not conducting murder investigations so much as life investigations. These journalists had lived in these towns and targeted the evildoers. I came in to tell a biography of the murdered journalists. So basically, they thought, okay, let him come in, do his little dance, and go back to where he comes from, and then, you know, it's not going to bother me here in Colombia or in a remote part of the Philippines. You know, he'll do his little thing and ride his little thing. However, if he's murdered in my town, the foreign press is going to come in. It'll cause me more trouble. But there's also another factor. If I overstayed my welcome and started writing for the local paper, pointing to the governor or the police chief as the bad guy, I would have lasted 5 minutes. So my family understood that I had the sensibility to do it exactly according to procedure and get in and stay a week, 2 weeks, I stay in Colombia for 6 weeks, and do the story about the life of this journalist, interview maybe 20 people around him, and the mastermind in a casual interview, which would be a little dance between us, and then I'd leave.
Are you working on another book at the moment?
Well, what I'm working on now, a lot of these places like Iraq, a lot of these journalists I spoke to who were friends of a journalist, a murdered journalist I wrote about in Iraq, Khalid Hassan, they were under severe threat. They too could be murdered any day. So I'm trying to help them. I'm trying to help get them out. And it's a very complicated procedure to get them out. Countries are not taking refugees the way they used to, and so it's a matter of finding them a safe place they can go, and I'm doing all kinds of negotiations to try and just get them out of there, because any day I expect to get a phone call.
This is a tremendous book, Terry. It's a valuable one, and you've done a great service. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck.
Well, thank you. It's an honor for me to be back on the commentary, and you too keep up your good work.
Thanks very much. The book is called Murder Without Borders, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It's published by Random House Canada. It's author Terry Gould on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.